This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The fight over the Supreme Court nomination is on. The focus is squarely on the Senate, as the Republican majority vows to bring a Trump nominee to the floor in the midst of a heated presidential campaign. But as that battle is being waged, Democrats in Senate races all across the country are polling surprisingly well and in some unlikely places, Arizona, Iowa, Kansas, all of which went for Trump in 2016. In South Carolina, a Democrat named Jamie Harrison, a 44-year-old black man, is running to unseat Lindsey Graham, who chairs the powerful Senate Judiciary Committee. Harrison seemed like a long shot early on, but a poll this month put them neck and neck, tied at 48% among likely voters. Jamie Harrison has been the associate chairman of the Democratic National Committee since 2017. He's a former lobbyist, and he worked in the office of Representative Jim Clyburn. We spoke last week.
Hello, how are you?
I'm all right. I'm probably, you know, a tad less busy than you, but... So as we speak, you are running in a race declared a tie in one major poll against Lindsey Graham, who's one of the most prominent Republican members of the Senate. You've been a party official, but you've never held public office. What happened? How have you gotten into this position? And what's the core of your contest with Lindsey Graham?
Yeah. Well, thank you, David. Thanks for having me. Listen, you're correct. I have never held public office before, but I've been around for a while in terms of public policy. I've taught ninth grade social studies. I've worked at a nonprofit. I've worked in the private sector, and I had a period of time when I worked on Capitol Hill for Congressman Jim Clyburn. I ran the whip operation, and I was the executive director for the House Democratic Caucus, and I served as chair of the state party here in South Carolina, and I currently am working at the DNC. And so I've seen public policy. I've seen the good, the bad, but I also have seen the power of how good public servants can really address the issues that people are dealing with on a day-to-day basis. And the problem that we have here in South Carolina, despite the fact that we have a wonderful state and great people, we just happen to have some feckless leaders. And Lindsey Graham is emblematic of that.
Lindsey Graham once called Donald Trump a race-baiting, xenophobic, religious bigot. Now, he doesn't call him that any longer. They play golf and they trade compliments and favors. But was he right in the first place?
Well, Lindsey's also called the president a kook. He's demagogue. Listen, I don't get into that business. My grandma taught me some good Southern manners, and part of that is that you don't throw names at people. You don't castigate folks. You may not like what they do, but you try to find the positive and move forward on that. I don't agree with President Trump on everything. I don't agree with him on a lot of things. But I'm not going to get into the schoolyard, let me call you names, like Senator Graham has done.
But it's not a matter of calling him names or calling him a jerk. It's calling things by their proper name. Is President Trump a racist? Is he a xenophobe? Is he a bigot?
I leave that for everybody else to make a determination. I can tell you in terms of my front and my opinion, I have not appreciated, the president's stance on some of these issues dealing with race. We need better. We need someone who can lead in that space, because it's a precarious time that we're in right now, and we need some real leadership that can unite us and not divide us. And I have not seen that from President Trump over the years. But listen, again, for me, this is a focus on the people of South Carolina, and none of that really matters to the folks. When we got folks here who are scared about their livelihoods because of the coronavirus, we have people scared about getting evicted from their homes. When we got folks who can't provide for their kids, that's the most pressing. Those are the most pressing things. You know, the characterization of the president doesn't address any of those issues.
What do you suppose turned Lindsey Graham around? What turned him from being somebody who's calling the president what I just described to someone who seems to be one of his closest friends in Washington? What happened?
Well, Lindsey Graham is all about Lindsey Graham. It's about political power and his political relevance. And he said, you know, he's just happy to be in the president's orbit. But that's not what the job of a U.S. senator is. The job of a senator is to represent your constituents. We got 38% of rural communities in this state that don't have any access to broadband. Just a few years ago, four of our rural hospitals have closed over the past few years. Issue after issue, we have a lot of things going on here in South Carolina, and we just need someone who will take the time and pay the attention to it and address it. But Lindsey hasn't even done a town hall here in the last 3 years. He's golfed with the president more than he's actually had town halls during the six-year term. That's not what we need right now in terms of representation.
On Friday evening, last Friday evening, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, at the age of 87, a longtime member of the Supreme Court and a hero to many, particularly among liberal constituency, died. And as you well know, Lindsey Graham in 2016 said that if the presidential race had entered the primary stage, that no president should appoint anybody to the Supreme Court, should there be a death or a retirement, until the presidential race was over. Now he seems to have changed his mind. How would you characterize that change of mind?
Well, listen, my grandfather told me when growing up, he said, a man is only as good as his word. A man is only good as his word. And Lindsey Graham, not on one occasion, but multiple occasions, gave his word to the American people, but more specifically to the people of South Carolina. He said that no nominee should be considered in an election year. He said that even with President Trump in the final year of his four-year term, that he would not vote for and consider a nominee in that time period. And now he is going back on his word.
You would say his word is worthless.
It's worthless. And my grandfather would say that is a lie. It's a bold-faced one.
And you would say that as well?
Yes, I would. The worst thing you can do as a public servant is to betray the trust of the people that you represent. And that's what Lindsey Graham has done. Now, this isn't the first time, but that's what he's done in this occasion. And it's sad. And I think honesty is going to be on the ballot on November 3rd.
As I said earlier, the race is now, according to at least Quinnipiac's poll, is tied at 48-48, which is kind of amazing considering how long Senator Graham has been in office and his seeming popularity in the state. How does the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the political battle that's already seemingly begun, how does that affect your race with Lindsey Graham?
I don't know if it does affect the race. I know that Senator Graham will take this prime opportunity to get in front of as many TV cameras as he can, because he actually likes that part of the job better than actually doing the work for the people here in South Carolina. But I'm going to constantly be doing what I've done for almost 2 years now, which is talk about the issues that people really care about.
What do you think the Senate Democrats should do to stop a replacement being named?
I think they need to remind folks of the precedent that is set. I think they need to constantly replay the words of the members who made a commitment that we were going down this road. It wasn't very long ago. So hopefully these members haven't forgotten what they said, and we can roll the tape. As Lindsey Graham said, use my words. And well, we're going to use your words, Senator.
Donald Trump is ahead by 6 points in South Carolina, even though you are tied. Why are some people for Trump and maybe for you at the same time?
Partly I can only tell you why they're for me. And it's because I'm talking about the issues that they care about. And I'm doing that in a manner that is not about Democrats versus Republicans. We've had four rural hospitals that have closed here in South Carolina. When your rural hospital closes and your grandpa has a stroke or a heart attack, complications with diabetes, or your wife has complications with her pregnancy, you don't care whether it's a Democrat or Republican in the United States Senate. All you care about is having a hospital to go to. And that's what I'm talking about. Lindsey is not talking about those things. He's running around with all of these hearings. He's running around changing this position and that position. He's, golfing. He's not having town halls. He's, just in front of, sitting with Sean Hannity every other night. And he's not addressing those issues. But I am. And that's the appeal that I think a lot of people have right now. And I'm going to always shoot straight with them. They might not always agree with me on everything. And I've told folks that. But they will always know where I am. And they will always know that I will never lie to them.
Tell us where you are on Brett Kavanaugh. Would you have voted to confirm him?
I had a lot of questions with Kavanaugh dealing with the issues surrounding the treatment of Dr. Ford. I wasn't privy to all of the information.
You listened to the hearing. Would you have voted for or against him?
Well, but I'm not a senator yet. And so when I am a senator, I will make those decisions based on the information in front of me. But I'm just telling you, there's a lot of ifs, ands, and buts in that. And right now, I'm focused on my folks here in South Carolina.
Who's your political idol? Who would you model yourself on in the Senate?
That's a good question. I don't know if I have a political model in the Senate, but partly because I don't think there will be anybody in the Senate like me.
How do you mean?
Do we know anybody in the Senate who grew up on food stamps, who was evicted from their home, lived in public housing, born to a single mom, raised by their grandparents? I mean, all of those things are the perspectives that I will bring to the United States Senate, which I think will be fairly unique. I hope that what I can do once I'm in the U.S. Senate is become a model for other kids who are growing up in this country just like me, and there are millions of them. I mean, I talked to so many single moms on this campaign thus far, and they just tell me, they said, I hope and pray that my son or my daughter can just get out like you did, right? Because they've been trapped in the cycle of poverty, the cycle that my family had been trapped in for generations, and I was able to break that and then help my family. And so that's part of the reason why I'm in this race. It's part of the reason why I've told folks I've already won. Despite what happens on November 3rd, it is because there have been young people who have come up to me with tears in their eyes, and they said, thank you so much for doing this, because you just give me hope that I can do something. And that's part of why I'm proud of the way that we have run this race. I'm proud of the results that we have gotten in this race. This is the David versus Goliath race of 2020. And I'm going to play this role to the hilt.
It's a rare thing that a freshman senator can get through with his or her leadership a piece of legislation. If you could do that, what would that legislation be? What would be the most important thing to you?
Well, it's probably also rare for a freshman senator to have the experience that I have. I mean, my job was to get the 218 votes to pass bills on the floor of the House. One of the things that I want to do is what we've rolled out just a few weeks ago. We rolled out a Rural Hope Agenda. In essence, an agenda to rebuild and revitalize rural communities across South Carolina, but across the country as well. It has five pillars about healthcare. It's tackling healthcare disparities in those communities, education, infrastructure, economic opportunities, and it also includes a Farmer's Bill of Rights. Because when I looked at South Carolina and asked, why is South Carolina on the top of all the bad lists and on the bottom of all the good? It's partly because our rural communities are dragging the state down in terms of those categories because of just historical neglect. Lindsey Graham's not talking about these issues, but I am. And I'm focused on this because I grew up in a rural community. I understand the joys of those communities, but the hardships that come in those communities as well. And I want to give those folks hope again. I want them to feel as though somebody, their senator, is fighting for them each and every day.
Mr. Harrison, I wish you luck. All the very best to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Jamie Harrison, a Democrat running for the Senate from South Carolina. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. As much as Donald Trump reviles what he calls the lamestream media, his presence in the White House has been an absolute boon to book publishers. The last 4 years have given us a wave of Trump books left and right, repertorial, and pontificating. Carlos Lozada, a Pulitzer Prize-winning critic at the Washington Post, assigned himself the perverse task of reading the entire Trump library as it emerges, from the vindictive tell-alls to the voluminous Mueller report. Now he's added to the pile with his critique of Trump studies called What Were We Thinking? And in it, Lozada tries to sort out whether these books actually matter at all. Carlos, so first question, when you were reading these stacks of Trump books and Trump-adjacent books, maybe 150 of them, there are so many. Did you ever say to yourself, is this a really good idea? What if I get hit by a bus and these are my last thoughts as a sentient being?
You know, what I try to do while I'm reading all these Trump books is that I sneak in, maybe like every four Trump books, I sneak in a novel or I sneak in an essay collection or something just to kind of keep my sanity going.
What set you off on this project?
Well, it started almost accidentally in 2015, actually, when Trump was first on the scene as a candidate and suddenly doing really well in the polls for the nomination. I decided just to read several of his own books, you know, The Art of the Deal and other memoirs and sort of self-help books that he has, just to see what I could learn about the guy. I thought it would be a very kind of one-time thing. But then suddenly he starts doing really well in primaries. So I start reading books about his supporters, right? Then he wins. So I start reading books about the resistance. And pretty soon I realized this was my beat at the Washington Post.
Now, one thing you note in your book, What Were We Thinking,
is how similar some of the titles of these books are. There's The Death of Expertise, The Death of Truth, Untruth, Truth in Our Times, Post-Truth, The Truth Decay, Donald Trump and His Assault on Truth, and on and on and on.
You know, one thing also that struck me about the titles is how often they use his words, right? Think about some of the most well-known books about the Trump era. Fire and Fury, American Carnage, A Very Stable Genius, Rage, Fear, right? They put Trump at the very center of the story, which I think is kind of how he likes it.
Now, tell me, what are the categories of these books? You have broad categories that you write about.
Right. I kick off with all the books about the white working class and the heartland that really dominated the first year of the Trump presidency. And even the campaign, books like Hillbilly Elegy and White Trash and Strangers in Their Own Land. I look at the books by and about conservatives, right? And to see the different camps that the conservative movement has broken into during the Trump years. I look at all the Russia, well, not all. I say all in these categories. There are so, so many. Out of about 1,200 Trump books total that people have estimated, I've only done this for about 150 books. But I read several Russia books, several books about democracy, which has become obviously a big debate right now.
Was there any genre of book that surprised you or where you learned a great deal more than you expected? I suspect that some of these books seemed awfully familiar.
I'll tell you one surprise. Two books about the white working class that came out in 2018, just months apart, they both profiled the same guy in this Trump County in Pennsylvania. And I was, of course, I mean, I had read several books in between. So suddenly I'm reading the second one and I'm thinking, wait, this person's familiar. Why do I know this person? Right. And then it hits me that I had read about him in a book called The Great Revolt. It had been published months earlier. And now he's reading about him in a book called The Forgotten.
Who was the guy and why was he so emblematic to these writers?
Well, the guy's name was Ed Harry, and he was a longtime Democrat who had even been a delegate to the 92 Democratic convention that nominated Bill Clinton, and he switched to Trump. But what was just delightful to read about Ed Harry is that depending on which book you were in, his motives for switching to Trump were completely different. So in The Great Revolt, he's this economic populist guy who worries about unfair trade deals and thinks the Democrats have forgotten the working man, and he doesn't like political dynasties like the Clintons or the Bushes. And in The Forgotten, the other book, he's a 9/11 truther who worries about George Soros funding Black Lives Matter. So he's sort of salt of the earth in one book and scorched earth in the next book. And I think he's the same guy. I doubt he changed a lot from when he spoke to one set of writers versus another. What really happened here is that these different qualities that the authors highlight seem to dovetail with their own interpretations of why Trump won the presidency. Even a single voter, let alone an entire demographic, can be politicized by authors, probably in good faith, interpreting things through their particular prisms.
Let's talk about Bob Woodward's book, Rage, which comes fast on the heels of Fury. It's the number one seller in America. It's gotten a ton of news coverage. What do you think about its strengths, or do you think there are weaknesses there as well?
I enjoyed reading Rage because Bob just gets a lot of information and he kind of lays it all out. And it's up to you to decide what to make of it. The sort of weird thing about Rage in particular, about this last book, is that it's two books in one. The part that's gotten a ton of attention has been the one-on-one conversations, you know, the 17 or 18 interviews between Woodward and the president. And, you know, what did Trump know about COVID and when did he know it and what did he say and should Woodward have said something? That's really only half the book. The entire first half of the book is told through the eyes of key national security officials in the Trump administration, particularly James Mattis, the former defense secretary. To me, that just as a reader was far more interesting because you see how deeply concerned Mattis was about, for instance, the real risk of a nuclear confrontation with North Korea. And there's these very intense moments when you see, you know, Mattis like sneaking off to go pray at the National Cathedral, right? Because he wants to have his mind ready so that he can respond instantly when something like that happens.
How do you feel about the standard critique of Bob Woodward's book and earlier books as well? Number one, that there's a system of source reward, as we say in journalism. In other words, those sources who talk to him get rewarded by being portrayed in the most heroic terms. And if you don't talk to him, you get punished.
I certainly understand that critique. Joan Didion laid out that critique most famously in a New York Review of Books essay in the 1990s.
Where she said that Bob Woodward basically has no analytical frame ever in these books, that it's pure information and that mental activity is not applied to it. There's no analysis whatsoever, which I think Woodward really cops to. But you also had this very unusual moment in the book at the end, in the epilogue, where Woodward, with great drama almost, concludes in a way that he never has, quote unquote, that he is not the man for the job, meaning that Trump is not the man for the presidency, to which I think a lot of readers might say, no kidding. We could have told you that 4 years ago. He's not the man for the job. Why is that a dramatic conclusion?
I think you see that his purely reporting instincts are hard to overpower, and they take a long time to get to the point where he can make a very definitive yet opinionated statement like he makes at the end of Rage, right? Those are the final words that he is not the right man for the job. And I think perhaps for someone like Woodward, who's covered a president since Nixon, you know, it takes him writing two books, it takes him amassing all the evidence to kind of give himself license to make a conclusion like that.
You know, I think the journalism that we publish at The New Yorker is heavily fact-checked and fair, but at the same time, it very often has a point of view. I've written with a point of view many times about Donald Trump, and I don't conceal that I think his presidency has been a disaster, an emergency on many levels and unprecedented in many levels. What should I read that I'm not likely to have read that would make me understand this, not necessarily change my mind, but understand the predicament more deeply?
What has helped me the most in the course of this reading is not necessarily finding like that one book that completely alters my worldview, for instance, but rather reading books that are not really about Trump, reading books that are about us, reading books that help me understand not just how we got to this moment, but how the fights that we're having now over immigration, over race, over identity and democracy, how those are ever present in the American experience. One of your own writers, Jill Lepore's book, These Truths, is an excellent look at precisely that.
Which is a history of the nation from its very beginnings, its pre-Columbian beginnings.
Right, but through the prism of those self-evident truths of the Declaration, right? And how our attempts and our inability to live up to them are a consistent feature of the American experience. To me, those have been the most helpful. Books like Carol Anderson's One Person, No Vote on the history of voter suppression. Books like Unmaking the Presidency by Susan Hennessy and Ben Wittes that don't just tell me all the awful things that Trump is doing in the White House, but show me where those norms that he is violating came from and what it can mean for them long term to be distorted. The best books about the Trump era are barely about Trump at all. They're about the country that he is remaking, unmaking, distorting.
Carlos Lozada, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
That was Carlos Lozada of The Washington Post. His new book is called What Were We Thinking?
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The TV series called Woke has an unusual premise. It's about a cartoonist who experiences a racial and political awakening after an episode of police violence.
Don't move.
It's Central. We have the suspect.
What?
6'12" black male.
What's in the bag?
He's got a weapon.
No, just the stapler. Look at that. No. You got the wrong guy.
Stop resisting.
Lamorne Morris plays Keith, who's based on the show's creator, Keith Knight. Knight draws the K Chronicles and other syndicated strips, and he's contributed to The New Yorker as well. Now, the world of cartooning, as you might imagine, is pretty small. So Emily Flake, a fellow cartoonist, wanted to talk with Keith Knight about what it means to break into television.
I haven't seen you since Mocha, maybe last year or the year before. Remember comics festivals?
I know. It's such a... And Mocha was actually the first time where I got the idea that I had accomplished something with the show, which I had already shot the pilot. And there were so many cartoonists that came up to me and said, "I can't believe you actually filmed a pilot." That was the first time I was like, "Oh man, if all the big New Yorker cartoonists are telling me this, then..."
Right. Yeah.
We might be getting somewhere.
Yeah. I do want to go back and get a basic overview of like the narrative of the show. So tell me the basics of the television show Woke.
Okay. The gist is that Keith Knight, the character inspired by myself, is just about to make it. He's on the verge of making it big with a very innocuous. Is it innocuous? Is that the right word? A very milquetoast, mild comic strip called Toast and Butter. And but then he has a wake-up call where he gets profiled by the police in a very harsh way, and it triggers something in him. And we call it opening a third eye, and inanimate objects start to be animated. So we start seeing inanimate objects, and they're telling him about gentrification, about PTSD, and about, you know, poisoning the black community, like all these different things.
None of this makes sense.
KVK, where you going? I know you hear me. Down here, my brother. That's right. I'm a talking trash can. I got eyes. I got a nose. I can smell things. I stink sometimes. I'm a trash can. And that ain't even close to normal, but you ain't even close to normal. Not anymore.
Oh, this is, come on, Keith. This is all wrong.
I tell you what's wrong. Those man bun co-opting gentrifying devils. That ain't no barber shop in there. That's a Negro land section of some hipster magical kingdom. Everybody's so fascinated with whiskey. What's left for a budding black man if we can't go to the barber shop? Therapy? You know we don't trust doctors. Spin class? We don't ride bicycles that don't go nowhere.
So it's this guy's journey to sort of come to terms with what's going on with him.
Was it weird to sort of like relinquish control over your world? Like, if something is drawn so much from your own autobiographical experiences, I feel like it's a whole different level of personal to you than, you know, than a novel you wrote or something like that. It's just like the character has your name.
Yeah. In many ways it is. Like, essentially what we're doing is taking 30, 35 years of my life and putting it in an 8-episode season. And
no pressure.
Yeah. And so everything is exaggerated or sort of, you know, dramatized. Mm-hmm. You know, my incident that happened with the police was not as hardcore as the incident in the show, you know? You know, when I hung up...
Do you want to talk about that incident at all?
Sure. I was hanging up posters for my band in the inner Richmond district of San Francisco. And yeah, a cop car pulls up across Fulton Street, jumps out. What are you doing? And I just turned around and said, I'm hanging up posters and I have a stapler and I'm going to put it down here. And, you know, he got on the radio and said, we have the suspect. And I said, what suspect? You know, somebody's been reporting somebody robbing houses in the neighborhood. I said, what's the description? They said 6-foot-tall black male. And that was it, nothing else. And I had huge head of hair that, like, I looked like Sideshow Bob. And it wasn't so much as traumatizing for me as, because they didn't throw me down. They didn't have a gun to my head or anything. But my white roommate was on a bus and he saw it from the bus. And he jumped off the bus and ran at the cops, screaming and yelling, going, get the F away from him, blah, blah, blah. And they were like, take it easy, bud. Take it slow.
Right.
Like they were treating him, I don't know, like he was the manager. And that to me was the most traumatizing thing, which was
absolutely
the cops are working for him.
Mm-hmm.
They are not working for me.
Look, I didn't do anything. I was just walking, and then Gunther showed up, and he took on the entire SFPD by himself.
Uh-huh. Yes, I did. I was pissed, dude. You should have saw me. I was all up in this cop's face when I, like, grabbed his wrist.
Yeah?
Probably bruised it.
They should have shot you.
No. Yeah, didn't have to do that.
I mean, they would have. You know, if he was black. Houston, we have a problem. This woke.
And I had been doing stuff about, you know, police brutality and racism, you know, long before that. But it made me double and triple down on the stuff that I was doing at that point.
I was going to say, let's talk about your sensibility for listeners who might not be familiar, like, with your work or with the comic that the show is based on. What would you say is, like, actually, I'm just going to let you talk about your sensibility for a second without asking a leading question.
Well, you know, I'll say it in the way it's been described. It's accessible yet subversive. So, you know, it's very approachable, but there's definitely a sort of indie FU type of attitude, which I totally see in your work, which is like you have this particular art style and it's very approachable. But I really like how, you know, you'll throw an FU in there. Like,
so, yeah, it's like taking a light approach to heavy subjects. One of my favorite strips of yours is this recent one, Keep Calm and Karen On. Your character is just sitting, hanging outside next to his mailbox. And this white lady busybody comes up and starts giving you trouble. Now, obviously, this is alluding to so much unpleasantness, but it has the drawing has kind of the visual sensibility more of like a fun Sunday cartoon that makes you sort of lulls you into thinking that, you know, it's just going to be funny. And then you realize it's talking about something very serious.
I always just found that, like, you know, making people laugh and then punching them in the face with like a serious issue is the way to work. And so I just approach these particular issues through humor, but
I think accessible yet subversive is the best thing you could possibly put on a business card.
Yeah, I know. I wish we had uses for business cards.
Right, seriously. But you know, you and I both come, you know, we're both Gen Xers. We both come from like the Alt Weekly world. I feel like coming from Alt Weeklies, like there was a freedom that came with that just because of the nature of Alt Weeklies. And I guess to back up in case there are any young people listening, Alt Weeklies being alternative news weeklies that circulated in major cities. Because I am an old person, they were absolutely crucial to my life in the 90s.
Yeah. But, Village Voice, Austin Phoenix, San Francisco Bay Guardian. I think, you know, when I got out of college, I just thought that being a cartoonist meant you got a daily comic strip in the daily newspaper. And it wasn't until I moved to San Francisco and I discovered all these, you know, undergrounds and indie publications, and they had all these different formats. And I was like, oh, wow, I can talk about this, and I can use profanity, and I can talk about. So it was very freeing.
And so in some ways, I feel like you straddle a lot of different genres, like in terms of autobio, it's a political strip, et cetera, et cetera. Like, do you think it's possible to have an autobiographical cartoon as a Black person in America without it being political?
That's interesting. I think he makes the point in the show that why can't, as a person, an artist of color, why can't I do comics just that aren't political? Like, why can't I just do stuff about? And in many ways, that's a burden because that is the dilemma of an artist that is a person of color, which is, do you work exclusively for the cause, or do you create escapist work? So, like, you know, this is happening all the time. So why not create something to take your mind away from it, to take your mind off of it? But yeah, I've always considered cartoonists to be the modern day court jesters. And I would like to thank CNN for transcribing that term, modern day court jesters. They put Marvin Gaye court jester.
No, did they
so
really?
We are the Marvin Gaye court jesters. But yeah, I mean, we speak truth to power, and we use humor to do that. And I just see that the TV show as an extension of that. I want people to laugh more than anything, but then I want people to think too, and hopefully call stuff out, you know?
Watching the show, I felt like, you know, there is an optimism in the show that already kind of felt like a before times luxury in some ways. Like, does that resonate with you at all?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And the show was written with the idea of that people are not paying attention to police brutality enough and not doing. So the fact that all this stuff happened over the summer, I remember just sending out a note to everybody going, we're going to watch the whole season play out before our very eyes, like right now.
Right.
Frankly, when people say, oh, how did you time it like this? And it's just like,
right.
You know what? This took place to me 20 years ago. Racism and police brutality are evergreen. I just wanted to make sure that the show didn't close the door. Like, right now is a moment for Black creators. And also, it's a moment for, I think, cartoonists too, because everyone's looking for IP. Hollywood's looking for IP. I just didn't want to be one of the projects that closes the door on that opportunity, which is like, I think it takes two flopped. So hopefully, hopefully the door is still open for everybody else to get in and develop their stuff.
Oh, absolutely. Keith, it is such a pleasure to talk to you always. And thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me on.
Keith Knight. He's the creator of Woke, a new series on Hulu, and he spoke with cartoonist Emily Flake of The New Yorker. Now, before we go, I want to check in on a friend I haven't seen in a long while, staff writer Gia Tolentino.
There she is, Gia.
I'm alive. I'm alive.
Now, it's nice to see you, but do we get a little display here or what?
You want to see? She's asleep in this like magical robot crib that I have.
Oh man! Oh man! Adorable. That crib looks like a flying saucer of some kind.
It's amazing. It senses your baby crying, and when it cries, it shakes a little faster, so it puts them back to sleep.
No.
As soon as we got the thing shipped, I was like, I want one of these for me. Like, I'm a lifetime incumbent. Where is my thing that will sense my late night anxiety when I read Jeffrey Toobin's article about all of the ways the election is going to?
Exactly. Exactly.
Which I did at 4:30 a.m. this morning.
Gia writes for The New Yorker about many things: the internet, feminism, culture in almost any form. And I always love getting her recommendations. Now, so you gave birth in early August.
I gave birth in early August.
We're now in late September. I mean, how much cultural consumption can you have been doing in those 2 months?
Well, I've used this opportunity of nursing a small baby. Like, I got off Twitter. I've been reading a lot of novels. And the first book I read after she was born was How Much of These Hills is Gold by C. Pam Zhang. And I read it like with her on my chest. And it's this kind of unbelievable Western survival story. It's set during the gold rush, but it's about a Chinese American family, and it's sort of Faulknerian. It starts with a dead body that needs to be buried, and it's switching perspectives. And it's, you know, this really like near gothic, really brutal, really tender story about parents failing to take care of their children and children having to take care of themselves. And it was an extremely intense thing to read, you know, start reading 6 hours after a child physically came out of me. But in a way, it kind of felt perfect. Like, it kind of made me think about the rawness of what it meant to just have a human being that I, you know, want to take care of and create some softness for in this increasingly harsh world, and how kind of bittersweet and monstrous and strange that is. But, you know, the book is really about, you know, it's a Western starring a Chinese family, and it's really about, it feels like a surreal reinvented history, but it's actually, you know, it's a real one, right? It's about this enormous Chinese population that helped build the West and then was erased from the story. And so, it was a really good, really intense book to read with a, you know, 24-hour old infant on my chest.
And what else has been in your life these past weeks?
You know, I feel like when you're up all night breastfeeding, you have to watch trash, you know, you have to watch. So I am not a reality TV show person. Despite having been on a reality TV show myself, like I never watch it. Like, I've never seen the Kardashians, never seen Real Housewives.
You've never seen the Kardashians?
No, have
not
you?
Not even the epical episode? Of course.
Really?
Oh, when Kim is thrown into the water and loses her earring, and it's like a nuclear
Aren't
holocaust.
Aren't there like 47 seasons of it though?
Well, I didn't say I watched every episode, but you know, the important ones.
Well, you know, maybe depending on how long this baby thing lasts, maybe I'll. But, you know, I guess I never, having a baby is the first time that I've been watching TV kind of just to pass the time. And it turns out the perfect show for that is the show Alone on the History Channel.
Totally alone. Nobody knows what it's like here except for the 10 guys out here doing it.
I'm going to get shelter.
There's nobody here but me.
It's so hard doing this alone.
So the premise is they drop off 10 people in the middle of the wilderness, like they're separate from each other. They have like 10 items that they can use to survive. And they just have to live off the land for as long as they can. And the last person remaining gets $500,000 or something. But the thing that I think is interesting about this show, I mean, the show is really, it's about who can build a canoe and who can, you know, make a fire in a hut from nothing without burning, you know, the whole place down, and who can dodge the cougars in Vancouver, right? But it's really about who has the inner psychological resources to last through such, you know, punishing solitude. My favorite contestant on season one was this guy named Alan, who is a bit of a philosopher maniac. And Alan, as I think you can see in this clip, really can keep it going for himself.
It's funny how time works here. I don't think about clocks or the hour of day, but I look out at the ocean and the tide now has become my clock. So I'm starting to get into a rhythm. First couple days has been challenging, trying to find my groove out here and get in it and just fit into the flow of nature.
Kind of a good pandemic lesson, you know, we all got to keep ourselves amused in our solitude.
What else have you had time for?
Well, you know, one of my favorite albums that's come out this year, it was what I was listening to when she was born, early in the morning, 15 minutes after I had woken up from a nap, and the doctor came in and was like, all right, we're having this baby. And I was like, what? I'm still asleep. And then the baby was born and it was crazy. But have you listened to the Moses Sumney album, Gray?
I have.
I love that album. And I think he's just, a genius. I think as soon as I listened to his first album, Aromanticism, I was like, okay, this is an artist we'll be listening to for decades. I mean, he reminds me of Bjork sometimes and Nina Simone or Joanna Newsom, Sufjan Stevens. And then, you know, you've listened to the album. There's this really sort of muscular, cerebral, like incredibly charismatic thing to his music and funny too. And it's kind of my first memory really of her after that first incredibly shocking moment where suddenly there's a baby. It's this like astonishing moment of revelation. But then when they were weighing her in the hospital, you know, she was next to me and my boyfriend were just staring at her, and it was a little bit quiet in the room for the first time in a while. And we could hear the song Me in 20 Years playing, and, you know, and Andrew was just sobbing, and I was just like, man, I was just astonished at, you know, what it is to be alive.
Gia, it's so wonderful to talk with you and to, and even by Zoom, to see the baby who's just, beyond. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. I'll see you soon.
I hope so. Take care, Gia. Gia Tolentino. For all you new parents out there, she's recommending the recent record by Moses Sumney, the History Channel show Alone, and the novel How Much of These Hills is Gold. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for listening today. I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.